I'm Rob Hirschfeld, CEO and co-founder of RackN and your host for the Cloud 2030 podcast. In this episode, we delve into spatial computing, or Apple's Vision Pro, the face computer. We were really intrigued because all of us in the Cloud 2030 group are interested in augmented reality and virtual reality. And this release, this product, the Apple Vision Pro, seems to cross over multiple lines that made us surprisingly optimistic about the potential to actually have a hit here. And we had a really thorough conversation about what we liked, what we didn't like, what we thought was going to be a challenge, and some of our surprises in this conversation. If you are watching this space at all, or new to this concept of a spatial computer from Apple, I think you'll get a lot out of this conversation. Enjoy.
The place where I've been seeing the most interesting change in the quality of what I'm getting back is with the multi-agent frameworks. AutoGen is one that I'm using. I'm finding I'm using a lot. And for prototyping, the AutoGen Studio is very good. And then once you kind of have it tricked out the way you want, you know, kind of going through and cleaning it up in kind of full-blown AutoGen. The nice thing about it is that it really does support function calling, so that any LLMs that you can, or, you know, tools that you can build that kind of reach out into the net for search or scrape or kind of transposition, it's very good for that. And it's also quite good for using local LLMs as opposed to foundation models that and multiples, so that you might have a coding agent that is using CodeLlama, for example, but a kind of general director or group manager agent that's using Mistral or one of the others. And the quality of what I'm getting off of both some, I won't call them one shots, but, you know, pretty ambiguously worded requests has been really good. And when you get serious about saying, this is how I want it to be done, and here's how I want to interact with the group of agents as a human user, really the code I've been getting out, and they're mostly functions defined, you know, the definition of functions in Python for the most part, as opposed to really long piece parts, have been really good. So I think there's a lot of value left in what's available to us today that most people are not using, or very few people are using.
Well, where I'm seeing something interesting, not quite along the same lines as Rich, but on the domain expertise side, I was just on the phone with a company that is doing fleet management for AMRs. So autonomous robots that are running around in grocery stores or the back of Walmart or Amazon or whatever. And they're feeding those not only the domain expertise of the ROS or operating system that they're using, but rather they're trying to break the wall, the walled garden around these fleets of AMRs, and they are truly walled gardens from the OEMs, to be able to integrate them into the back office systems of manufacturing. And for that, you do need domain expertise. So think about an ERP or an MES or a PLM system that would be part of a digital thread or a digital twin. And now you need to start integrating this next mm-hmm. level up toward what I would call a cognitive twin, where you're not just getting the visualization, but you're actually getting the data of in the palette that you just picked up, call it Mr. AMR, there could be piece parts for manufacturing that are not carbon neutral or do not meet our compliance for sustainability. And we need you to take that, instead of taking it to the production line, we need you to reroute yourself back into the warehouse to another part of it where these are non-compliant, non-ESG compliant products. Mm-hmm. And that level of domain expertise using agent bases such as that you described, mm-hmm. Those are really interesting. Because then you're really taking the notion of cyber physical system to the level to which it was intended.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen anybody using indexing or approaches other than, or in addition to, kind of standard vector databases and vector, you know, kind of standard indexing, looking for similarity? Have you seen anybody using graph networks in addition, or hybrids where you have keywords and relational databases integrated with the LLMs, with the agents?
I'm starting to see it. If you take a look at Boston Dynamics' recent announcement with what it's called Spot, it's called Orbit. That is the beginning of it.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I think you're going to see much, much more of it. As a matter of fact, that whole sector of robots and cobots being integrated back towards what would be traditional systems is a hot new area, and that will definitely require the vertical, the kind of databasing and indexing that you're talking about. But you know, it's really taking it from the perspective of, this is an HMI that is easily understandable, and that's the whole attraction of the ChatGPT or the general purpose, and then taking that up a notch. Right, with the agencies. But again, that requires domain knowledge. And really the question is going to become, how do you capture the knowledge, tacit and implicit, of the human in a way that makes sense? It's like, do you create an LLM base or some lang chain to ask the right question of the individual about their job, and then start amassing all of that information in some form? Like
I actually have been talking to two different organizations about that very question. And my personal approach, my personal opinion on that is that it's a combination, that in point of fact, asking people and kind of interrogating them, you know, trying to elicit from them, is very much like what folks were trying to do as long ago as 20 years ago with expert systems. They were trying to, but that's historical. It's trying to be predictive, but it can fail. What is useful and becoming and becomes more useful over time is the notion of using the assistant, the apprentice, the co-pilot, mm-hmm. To be a teachable co-pilot. And part of that teachability is adding to the kind of the domain knowledge that you were just describing. Corner cases, new situations that show up, and using the notion of the apprentice that oversees, kind of looks over the shoulder of the programmer, designer, you know, the human expert, asking questions when it sees something that it doesn't see, doesn't understand as being conventional, or why, where it doesn't understand, if you'll pardon the expression, why the human has taken a particular approach. Kind of the co-pilot as a very active source of extending domain with teachable agents, the kind of information that's kind of stored in as kind of long memory context that at a certain point in time is found to be useful and therefore kind of incorporated into the training data set. Those seem to be the ways to do it. And it's a process that keeps going as opposed to, you know, trying to kind of do a brain dump off of the experts.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, one of the ideas that I've been kicking around, and it's very much along the line of what you just described, was creating the co-pilot to run on the back of the intern or the apprentice, like the human intern or the human apprentice.
Yeah, as actually both.
Yeah.
Both the intern and the expert. And yeah, you're absolutely
yes.
Correct.
And then bringing those together into what would be, in my view, the learning management system for domain expertise to add onto any LLM or whatever, where you're going to be able to understand where the co-pilot will quickly recognize the lack of experience of the intern or the apprentice, the tremendous expertise of the expert, and somehow try and find that middle ground so that the training becomes iterative.
Yes, exactly. The training of the human being as well as the training of the agent data source. Uh-huh. And that's one of the things that seems to be quite evident is that, and this goes back to your force multiplier comments, the level of productivity that companies, enterprises are reporting, and I don't know, right at this point, it's mostly anecdotal, but the productivity that they're seeing with their experts is significant, but the level of productivity as a, you know, to the degree it's being measured for their mid-tier employee and is significantly greater. In other words, the multiplier, the degree to which you're giving an employee a superpower depends on their kind of base understanding and base, you know, kind of base usage, so that they're actually seeing greater productivity or a greater productivity delta from their kind of rank and file employee using co-pilots.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's going to be very interesting. And I don't, you know, as much as I might use the term force multiplier, to me, it's much more of a flywheel. You're adding value every time you iterate, and the iteration should actually become more challenging with each new introduction.
Well, this is a good entry point to the topic that we were going to take on today, and that is, are we really talking about augmentation as opposed to
nice transition.
Replacement?
Right.
I literally got into this business because of, Doug Engelbart's NLS and seeing the mother of all demos umpteen decades ago. And their whole, and Engelbart's whole approach was not, and this was a point in time when AI was being bandied about, just not very useful. The whole point was intelligent augmentation or intelligence augmentation, just the whole notion of augmentation as opposed to replacement. And I see a similar kind of distinction between AR and VR. So,
I've been having fun listening to reviews of the Apple Vision Pro, aka Face Computer. that's still my favorite.
Which I
think is fascinating, and it is a legitimately a AR VR blend, which they're desperately calling spatial computing. But I didn't get it until somebody was actually talking in the review about being able to look around like cook. They were actually the cooking one actually was interesting. So the interactions are fast enough that even though it's not actually transparent, it's fast enough that the cameras in front of your eyes can give you feedback fast enough that it doesn't look like you don't get the video lag of the feed through. So the guy was cooking using a Vision Pro, and he could put timers on top of things that needed time and then move away, and the timer stayed where, like, over the dish he was cooking.
Which is this is the kind of augmentation that I think is a perfect example, and it's simple. And when you first see it, it kind of blows you away, but it becomes, well, of course, that's exactly the kind of augmentation we'd love to have in our normal day.
Yeah. So it's the beginning of being able to look at something and then recall, like have the AI identify what it is and then overlay information on top of it. That's, I keep going to Venervin, Rainbow's Edge, one of my favorite science fiction books. Hold on, I'll find the. If you haven't read this, it's a great AR VR book.
Are you talking about Brin?
Venervin.
Yeah, well, Werner Ving.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see.
Oh, yeah, his series on AR is great.
Amazon is not happy with me at the moment. There it is. Okay, here's the book. Nope, that's not the book. one of those days. Okay, here we go. I'll give it to you from Barnes & Noble. But no, one of the things I loved about that book is it was the first book I read where they were really overlaying the environment enough. They were like, we don't have signs anymore. We don't have streetlights anymore because people are wearing these augmented reality units that basically are like, oh, I'm going to show you where the curbs are and all the stuff. And it doesn't, we don't have to put signs in it out anymore, even lights. Yeah. Here's the correct link. Fun book.
Yeah. Which rainbows in, right?
Yeah.
I like and appreciate augmented reality.
Okay.
I do not like, nor do I appreciate, virtual reality. It literally makes me ill.
Mm.
And I think anybody who has any kind of visual impairment feels similarly. Unless the glasses themselves are VR glasses, which are correcting your vision at the same time as they're, you know, doing whatever. I mean, you know, metaverse is a nice fantasy world, but I don't see us moving in ways that are truly, and maybe we're just not there yet, embracing of the virtual realities in any productive way, other than the use of the technologies for, you know, diagnostics or whatever.
For AR or for VR?
For VR. AR, I definitely see it.
Okay. I think it's a much harder computing problem than the VR in that perspective. Great, because I've had VR sets for years and years. And I don't use them, frankly, I don't use them very much because they, you know, I don't have the visual impairments, but I get, it'll still make me nauseous and sick because of, you know, time lag or, you know, I'll get missed frames. Like there's stuff where I'm like, my computer can't keep up. And so I just close my eyes and wait because otherwise it makes me feel motion sickness.
Yeah.
And you can't see your hands. One of the things I liked about the Vision Pro is because of the way they're doing it, even if you were in a virtual space, because they have a roller that lets you convert from an AR to a VR space. If you lift your hands up in that headset, it'll show you your actual hands. Like they're actually using motions on your hands. Hold on just a second.
Yeah, it's I don't know about you, Rich, but I just find the virtual reality doesn't do anything for me that I can't do myself.
Well, the only thing
augmented on the other hand is really good.
I'm absolutely with you. I've not seen anything that is pure VR that, you know, I guess if I were a bigger gamer or, you know, something like that, it might be interesting. But
the gaming, you know, the gaming experience to me is preferable to a regular gaming experience. I prefer, really, really prefer the immersive aspect of gaming in a VR headset.
Sure. I can see that. But other than that, I've yet to see a VR, truly a VR situation that, you know, was at all appealing. But I put a lot of that to the fact that the technologies involved just ain't there or haven't been there.
They haven't.
I mean, you've made the point that technically everything you're doing with a Vision Pro is VR. I mean, they right. are, in fact, you know, you are completely immersed in that video. It turns out that they're taking feed from, you know, where you are locally and playing that through to you. Right. They are creating an AR environment, the cooking example with the timers. So I absolutely get that. I can see entertainment, you know, I can see immersive film, you know, movies, content. Absolutely. That I'm sure is going to be, one of the big draws for Vision Pro over the course of the next year and a half. The other thing that's going to happen, and apparently they already have it in beta for developers is they have direct connections to Macs, you know, via the I don't know if it's all USB-C or just the Thunderbolt, but you can power Vision Pro off of that.
Oh,
you don't have to have a separate. You don't have to have a separate battery pack. Okay. So you're literally, you know, plugging your Vision Pro into a USB-C style port on your Mac, and you can get two simultaneously without any problem. Full-on Mac screens, you know, with about as much, you know, real estate on each one of them as you could possibly want. Those are the kinds of things that I think are going to make a big difference for professional use, kind of enterprise and productivity use.
I have right this. I mean, it's expensive. The idea of being able to use it on an airplane, right, seems really interesting to me. There's a part of it where I'm like, I can imagine the airlines from a safety perspective being like, you know, we're not okay with you in, you know, in that immersive, you know, world, even if you could actually see what's going on around you. I expect for frequent travelers, the ability to plug in plug this in, watch stuff, talk on your computer, actually have some spatial awareness of what's going on in the, on the flight.
Ben Thompson and the Daring Fireball guy, John Gruber, discussed that this past week exactly. And Thompson, who's on planes all the time, said it was transformative. It was the best. Said anybody that travels, you know, more than once a month on an airplane on a significant flight, the $3,500 is worth it.
I bet. Yeah. No, it's, I've been considering it from that perspective. It would be absolutely crazy. Or even sitting in some of this strikes me as horrible and great at the same time. Like if I'm sitting in a conference, right, I can look at the speaker and talk to the speaker, and I can pull up resource information. I can, like, there's like, the ability to augment that experience seems really, really powerful. It's just, you know, I'm terrified of being in a conference, walking through a conference where it's like everybody's in their own goggles. Although it's at that point, you know, ideally, if I walked up past somebody and I was also wearing the Vision Pro, I would actually interact.
An experience, like experience-wise, this is not the first time that we've seen a paradigm shift like this. Mm-hmm. Like when laptops became powerful and portable enough that students started using them, it became a big problem for teachers and professors at universities, because suddenly you lost that eye contact. Your students, most of them ended up just staring at the screen while typing. As a conference presenter, this would be problematic as well. Even with like the eyes plastered on the outside screen of the headset, it's not the same.
No, it's not. You know, where I can see the use, and you really need to, I think there's more progress that needs to be made on the spatial computing side, is for product development, right? You ideate a product, you want to see it in something that is more materials oriented or fluid, you know,
it's something dynamic, that's a motion simulation of something mechanical, for example.
Well, a motion simulation, but also on the material side of it, right? Like you want to see how much flex there is in a resin or how much you know, photovoltaic property or whatever. I can see it being very useful for things like that and the rapid development of new products. But beyond that, to Klaus's point, I think the and to what Rob said earlier, I think it's yet another disintermediation of humanity. And that bothers.
And it's also going to worsen the class divide. Like going back to the airplane thing. Like, sure, if you're flying business class or first class, I can see you using that. But in an economy seat, where you barely have enough room to pull a book out of your bag? No, that's not going to happen.
Actually, that was more it was the opposite. Ben Thompson, who flies to Taipei, Taiwan all the time, said, I you know, often have to fly economy where you cannot open a laptop in economy, but I can open the laptop just enough to, you know, kind of keep the screen live and plug in to it. And I have full access. I can use the keyboard. He said the one thing that he found difficult was that using a Mac, you know, putting Mac screens up on Vision Pro, he said that sometimes the visual identification of where the mouse is or what the point is tends to jump about, and so you don't have the same kind of hand-eye collaboration that you do when using the mouse or a trackpad, and he misses that.
That was the comment I saw in one of the reviews, was that using he didn't realize how often his mouse was in advance of his eyes, that his eyes were, you know, having to focus on something, he found himself moving his eyes to the next thing before, and he didn't realize how much that was a learned behavior. Go ahead.
The last thing that would be concerned about as well is the dystopian potential of this kind of thing. Like, how long, like, let's say that the use of these kind of enhanced reality goggles becomes widespread. How long until airplanes stop having windows? Because you can just plaster it on the...
I think it's
perfectly rational and a perfectly important thing to point out. You're going to start to simulate realities, among other things.
That book is so good. Y'all read. Yeah.
Which is the Rainbow's End. The other thing, that going back to a previous comment, you were talking about, interpersonal interactions and what does it do there? Well, eye contact, obviously, but I can imagine manipulating nonverbal communications in a human to human situation. I mean, if I want to sit there and say, at all times, you know, present me as being attentive and my body position is, you know, looking at you, and I'm sending you all of the cues that you usually use to kind of get a sense of, you know, am I making a connection or not? When in point of fact, you know, I'm lying on my back snoring, and, you know,
we'll do the same thing. Well, I want to talk about their facial reading thing, because they have actually, you know, I think it's somewhere in the uncanny valley, but this idea that, you know, they're projecting a face of your face and then reading your expressions pieces, they're doing it pretty well.
Yes, but you can also, you know, the same technologies can be then used to kind of say, all right, present me as smiling and, you know, in a certain
present
way.
Present me as happy, right? Plus up my mood. Plus exactly. up my mood, or I'm negotiating with you. I want you to make me look more stern, or like...
Or yeah, take whatever role you'd like to present with body language. And then Chris Voss... book, you know, comes to mind when he talks about body language.
That's right.
Yeah.
And how important that is.
And imagine we're about to get to, right, AI, you know, auto-tuning for your tone. So you can do the same thing from a tonal perspective.
Oh, of course.
Right.
Yeah. When everything you say is going to be auto-tuned.
Exactly right. Think of how important face-to-face communication is going to become from that perspective.
Or how disappointing people are going to find real face-to-face communication after growing up as a kid with this.
It's also going to make political debates a lot more detached from reality than they are now.
I don't know how you can get.
I heard an interesting thing on the radio yesterday. They were talking about dating apps, and that dating apps, people are getting frustrated with dating apps, and they're switching to hybriding. So they're the trends, right? People were like, they thought dating apps would take out, you know, in person dating, or at least, you know, meeting people like outside of the outside of the app. And what we're seeing here is that people are like, that's not as full experience. I have to go back to in person. So it's we're sort of like using these systems for where they're effective and fast. I mean, back to our AI conversation. And then shifting over to say, you know, high bandwidth in person is actually preferable from that perspective.
But there's also, but part of that, and I've read a number of articles with regard to this, because of the human communication and my view of disintermediation, is there is so much distrust of the dating apps per se, because there was so much scamming and so much, you know, malfeasance going on in the background of it, that people have come to the point of realizing that unless you're face to face, IRL, you really have no clue who you're dealing with. And to the point of, you know, the Vision Pro, would you really put all of your trust and faith in the attuned versions of yourself being represented going forward? I would
not
never negotiate.
Even close.
It's my beauty. It's always my beauty pose. I know the stressors on this stuff, I think, are high. What's interesting to me in this conversation, stepping back from it, is this is a transformative device in the way we're discussing it. They have accomplished something here that, the way we're discussing it, indicates that we've already sort of accepted a new reality, and we're making an assumption that it's hit whatever milestones that were necessary for us to be sort of passive. Right. Like Google Glass was cool, but it was like it wasn't material enough. This one, we're actually, you know, I'm curious, because I'm tempted to buy one. I think it would be cool and interesting. It's just hard for me to justify the money. Even, you know, letting Rakan pay the bill, I'm still like, that's a lot of money. But I would get one.
Go ahead, John.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. I just want to make one point, though.
Yeah.
We are all of a certain age and experience.
Okay.
Ask a Gen Z what they think of it.
Hmm.
And you will have a group that is 100% enamored. Actually, it's now the Gen A, the younger than the Gen Z, who will become completely enamored by it because of its novelty and also its utility. But as you go through the age groups, I think you're going to find more and more commentary around, more leaning towards what our collective perspective might be, as opposed to the younger group, right? We've grown up with a tremendous amount of digital technology that we see both the pros and the cons from a societal and human impact point of view, as well as a utility point of view of productivity. Those that are that much younger than we are may know no other reality and have only such a limited experience before they get into this that their views will be very skewed in comparison.
Yeah. I was going to say something along the same lines, particularly that I see a lot of parallels between these devices and tablets when they first came out. And I have to admit that when tablets first became popular, I considered one and I actually purchased one as a potential desktop replacement. But at that point, I had not considered the implications of losing the haptic feedback on the keyboard. And so learned my lesson. But I think we're going to see something similar here with Google Glass having been the equivalent of the original tablets, so limited features, and these new devices being closer to, let's say, Chromebooks now, which are like, I see Chromebooks as having been the evolution of tablets, the scientists having learned that you cannot just have an Android OS or an iPad without the physical component to complement it for productivity. In this case, in the case of the Apple device, it's not so much a physical component; it's the environment part of it.
It's the UX. No, it's a new user experience from a computing perspective.
But it's efficient. It's yet to be.
Yeah, your point, Rob, in of that acceptance. There were smartphones out before the iPhone.
Yeah,
I remember picking up the iPhone the first day and unboxing it and you know, just kind of being in awe, recognizing it was the, you know, version one, and it had failings, but it was clear to me at that point that while it might not be as functional across the board for everything I needed in a phone and a PDA, you could see where it was going. And this I think is the same. We're to Joanne's point, yeah, we have a lot of experience and we have history. We've seen a lot of tech, but we're still talking about VR, AR, mostly in terms of past technologies. We're still in the horseless carriage community, as opposed to, you know, the generation that has no past history and is going to start coming up with approaches to its use that we haven't even, we don't think about, we can't consider yet.
Well, look at the rabbit. Look at the popularity of it from release.
The what? Right,
that new device that...
Really? I mean, a lot of people bought it or put in orders, but it hasn't really made it out. And I don't know... I don't think it's going to make it, actually, to be quite frank. But, yeah.
But I'm... Sorry, I
don't know what device.
I'm out of it there.
Like a handheld AI specific.
Oh, device. I've seen things about this. Okay,
yeah. Cool.
and, you know, had some slick design from teenage, you know, teenage, the teenage design, teenage electronics, whatever. And it's very inexpensive, has a built-in camera, so you can do image work with it. I think it's going to be short-lived.
And so, okay, I think it's a new era of the devices, and I think what's going to happen with the Vision Pros is we're going to see specialized versions come out
that
suit the needs of the consumer community based on the feedback of the Gen A's, Gen Z's, early millennials, much
and
more.
And the industrial or enterprise uses. You're going to see a version of the Vision Pro that's for airline mechanics or, you know, something like that.
And it's just the device version of the domain expertise that's needed to complement or augment the LLM technology. I mean, general purpose is a catchphrase. We need specialized expert systems. So giving us the general Vision Pro, I mean, like I said, I'm big on AR, but VR kind of leaves me kind of like Rob, motion sick, you know, and I'm not a gamer.
The other thing also to consider, and this goes back to the comment about Gen Z and Gen A, is that unlike us, who are a generation that uses computers or that has grown with computers, and we as professionals use them, there's a large demographic of Gen Z and Gen A that have never seen the need to have a computer because they have their smartphone. That's the market that these devices are going to flourish in.
I'm interested in seeing, as I think most of us are here, what is going to come out that's less expensive, focused on AR as opposed to VR, and kind of approachable in the sense of being modular enough to, you know, add technology to it, remove piece parts, make it modular, but also incorporate some very smart kind of back ends for it. So I give a year, 18 months to.
So here's something fascinating, and I need to wrap up today because I've got to jump off the call. But I do want to build on what Rich said, and then we'll wrap, which is this has all the bells and whistles in it, because they don't know what are bells and what are whistles yet. But I think it's going to be fascinating to see what the device actually doesn't need. To accomplish whatever the killer app is once the killer app emerges. And they're pretty, I like that they're opaque or they're transparent in saying that they don't know what the killer app is yet. It's a cool device. Yeah. All right.
Well, I'll tell you one killer app, and then I promise I'll be quiet and let you go, is I hear rumors around the streaming services being the killer app for the Vision Pro, the immersive movie. The immersive entertainment. It's going to be about that. And it's going to be, unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, the in-vehicle entertainment system. Don't laugh. Already in touch.
All right.
Yeah.
I'm
skeptical.
You have the over-under on the first Apple Vision Pro crash lawsuit.
Oh, man.
I mean, there's already been news of people in Teslas using full self driving while wearing the Apple headset.
I love it.
Insane. All right.
With that, I'm going to let us wrap up. I'll talk to you next week.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Wow, what a fun conversation and a really interesting way to end what I think is a remarkable product and one that I think we're going to be watching pretty carefully as a group. And I'm looking forward to hearing from people who've actually used this. If that is you, we would love to have you come join us. It is an open forum. Come in, be part of our discussions. That is how this Cloud 2030 discussion group works. We would love to have you on. You can find out all the details and our schedule at the2030.cloud. I'll see you there. Thank you for listening to the Cloud 2030 podcast. It is sponsored by RackN, where we are really working to build a community of people who are using and thinking about infrastructure differently, because that's what RackN does. We write software that helps put operators back in control of distributed infrastructure, really thinking about how things should be run and building software that makes that possible. If this is interesting to you, please try out the software. We would love to get your opinion and hear how you think this could transform infrastructure more broadly, or just keep enjoying the podcast and coming to the discussions and, you know, laying out your thoughts and how you see the future unfolding. All part of building a better infrastructure operations community. Thank you.